Hello and welcome to Pete's Percussion Podcast. I'm your host, Pete Zambito, and we're here with episode 433 and part one of my conversation with the longtime director of percussion activities at Colorado State University, percussionist and educator Eric Hollenbeck. We'll get to him shortly. But first up, again, how's everybody doing? There's a lot going on right now. Educationally, health, politically. Additionally, while all that's going on, at least in the mid-Missouri area, the weather has been really strange for what we normally deal with. As I record this right now, we have been dealing with at least our fourth, if not our fifth, snowstorm of the year, which included a surprise early appearance of snow this past Monday morning that shocked everyone, including the newscasters who did not predict it, and forced classes and everything else to adjust on the fly. It's been wild and have had temperatures hovering in single digits or below that this past week, which is very unusual for this time of year. And we've had to go to remote classes with regularity, which is less than ideal, but we've still been able to manage. So we're all hanging in there over here, and I hope you are as well. And with that, let's get to our conversation with Eric Hollenbeck. I've been meaning to have Eric on the show for a while, but I finally went ahead and reached out and was thrilled he was up for doing it. I had been aware of him for a long time, but learned much more about him through conversations with previous podcast guests Shiloh Stroman, who works with Eric at Colorado State, and Andrew Ling, who studied under Eric for one of his grad degrees. Eric has been in his position at Colorado State for over 20 years, earning the position as the first full-time faculty percussion instructor at the university. He's built up quite a program and profile over there, working with a lot of great students and performing with those groups and on his own for many years. He's been active locally, nationally, and internationally as a performer as well. We get to a lot in this conversation, including the program at Colorado State, the state of percussion at universities, the audiences we play for, growing up in New York State and his percussion sound influences. We continued the conversation later in the day and got to so much more that we needed to put this in two parts, and we'll get to part two next week. So let's get to part one right now. We recorded this portion of the interview over Zoom on February 14th, 2025, and it begins right now. Eric, give me a summation of your percussion activities and responsibilities as they are at this point.
At this current time, I'm basically director of percussion studies at Colorado State University. I've been here. This is my 22nd year, actually, so I've been here a little while. Yeah, basically, we are a master's and undergraduate program. We do not have a doctorate. But we typically, I oversee percussion lessons, percussion ensemble in all its forms. And we have kind of a mixture of typically 4 degrees for undergrad, and that's music therapy, BA, music performance, music education. And then we have a master's in performance that I see. We also have a master's in music ed, and I've had a few of those students, but primarily master's students in performance. Because we don't have a PhD program, I also don't have the GTAs that are associated with that. So I do typically have 3 or 4 master's students in performance. One of those, I have a GTA through the marching band. Basically, it's a drumline allocation. But past that, I'm like the PhD or DMA student that would be at a typical university. In other words, there's a lot of kind of other things that I have to purview, like equipment inventory. All that stuff is kind of under my purview, as well as individual lessons, curriculum, teaching percussion literature to master students. I do not do percussion methods. Actually, I've got a counterpart, Shiloh Stroman, who teaches pretty much everything I do, but he tends to specialize more towards jazz, drum set, jazz, vibraphone. But he teaches the methods classes and kind of is the overview consistent person in the drum line. And then we have a GTA master student that kind of works under him for the drumline, if that makes sense. So, yeah, it's not necessarily a traditional position. I am the first full-time faculty for percussion. Actually, I was hired in 2003, and this is the first time that we didn't have an adjunct in this position. Mm. Actually, the first tenured person in this position. So, which comes with a lot of terrific things. In other words, I don't have a predecessor that I was trying to fill shoes, you know, necessarily. There was a lot of things that I kind of created and designed and put into kind of consistency. In other words, there's no expectations, which is great. So there's a lot of things that I was able to get how I wanted it because nobody really knew any different. Sure. So, yeah. And I've been here a while. So, and I don't plan on leaving for a little while. Oh, so.
Nice. Do you do any performing?
I do, yeah. Not as much now as far as the large ensemble stuff that I used to do, but I originally, when I got out here, I won the principal position with the Fort Collins Symphony and the Cheyenne Symphony, and then I had subbed with the Colorado Symphony down in Denver for a period of about 7 or 8 years. I did that. Now I don't hold those positions anymore, but I occasionally sub, in particular with the Fort Collins. And then I play in some of the local symphonies like the Strings Music Fest up in Steamboat. Occasionally I'll play in Cheyenne. Occasionally I'll play with CMF, which is Colorado Music Festival down in Boulder. Occasionally I might sub with the Colorado Symphony. So it's more of an occasional event. But most of my playing in the last probably in particular 6 or 7 years, slightly before COVID, has been geared more towards my solo playing and solo rep stuff, which typically every year I've been trying to put out at least a couple videos of either commissions or, and just doing recital work pretty much is what I've been kind of gearing my creative playing stuff towards. Yep.
Well, tell me about getting the position. You told me kind of a little bit of the history of the position, but what was the situation you walked into? What was the equipment situation you were dealing with, all of those kinds of things?
Yeah. To give you a little bit of background, I think what helped me get the position, I was position pretty much was searched by the director of bands at that point, a guy named Steve Moore, who was terrific. And I was really lucky to work under, but Steve was very unique in the fact that he was director of bands, but he did the marching band too.
Sure.
He had Steve is known for his time in Kentucky as the director of, I think it was a Lafayette High School band, which is a really high-end kind of band program, marching band program and band program in Kentucky, and had kind of generated his reputation for that. Anyway, so when he came out here, he wasn't, even though he's director of bands and conducted the Wind Symphony, our top wind ensemble here, he still did the marching band because he saw it as a really valuable thing and wanted kind of do that. So he wanted the percussion instructor, that's me at that point, to have equal footing in the marching band. So I actually was, in a sense, kind of hired as a drumline instructor. Mm-hmm. Now, they had a studio, but the studio was only 5 or 6 people at that point. Now, I had a previous position at University of Alabama at Birmingham, UAB, that was almost identical to that in the fact that I was hired primarily to do the drumline, which they had just started at UAB the year before I got there. Mm. And then they had a couple studio members, not too different than here, actually, at CSU. But eventually I was able to grow the studio and my responsibilities kind of shifted. Same thing here. When I first got here, really, it was heavy drumline. Steve and I rocking this marching band thing and really trying to get it going and building it. And so I did the marching band here for about, I think it was 6 years, actually. I did the marching band here. And then got to the point where I was ABD at the point when I got hired. I finished my doctorate. Was going up for tenure. And part of the tenure process for me anyways, it was, you know, I wanted to get tenure with the auspice of the following tenure that maybe I can move on past the marching band. And those responsibilities could be divvied up to somebody else. And it just so happened that Steve left right around that same time, went to University of Miami down there, where he actually was in an administrative position. But anyways, I had applied for several other jobs with the interest of trying to get out of doing the marching band thing. And I enjoyed marching band. I was just kind of at the end of my energy battery for doing marching band. And I had done it at UAB for 6 years. And I also, as a graduate student at University of Illinois, had done it several years. Plus, I had some drum corps in me. And so I had my years of marching, and I was really interested in trying to move on. And I also had my years of being a symphonic player. I played with the Columbus Symphony for several years. And then I was also playing out here, probably between Colorado Symphony, the Fort Collins Symphony, and Cheyenne. In those positions, I was probably playing about 20 concerts a year, if not more. So between all the marching band in the fall and then all the concert playing, it was really way too much.
Yeah.
And I was trying to steer myself towards being really more of an orchestral, typical applied percussion teacher. Yeah. And that's how things kind of rolled. And eventually they granted me a GTA and were able to get another person to assist me. And that was Shiloh, really.
Yeah.
Back in those days. So he kind of oversees the drum line and then, you know, teaches jazz. And then I had a GTA student that would be out there regularly, you know, hour by hour with a marching band to kind of govern that. So it's allowed me to kind of refocus, you know, for a while. And that's been a while now. That's, you know, been close to 15 years when that happened a while ago. So, yeah, that's how the position kind of evolved, if you will. But, I mean, I've been the first kind of full-time person here, and something that I've really kind of pushed for and moved towards is developing the percussion ensemble and chamber music in particular is something that I did my doctorate at Northwestern, and that was a heavy orchestral prep school. Mm-hmm. And so I still do things here as far as we do large ensemble auditions at the beginning of every semester to place. And those are straight up orchestral auditions, you know, on each instrument, blind. All the way from my top master student to my beginning freshman play the same rep. It's like Lieutenant Kiji, Porgy and Bess, you know, Magic Flute. It's usually in 5 or 6 instruments that are blind, and everybody gets evaluated like an orchestral audition. There's a high score, there's a low score. And that's kind of the only competitive thing I do here, but that is kind of my remnants of Northwestern and how we kind of used to operate there. But yeah, that's how it's kind of rolled. That makes sense.
Kind of the second part was about the gear. What was that situation when you got there?
Yeah, I mean, I was lucky. Again, I didn't have any expectations. So when I came in, I think they were definitely under the auspice like, hey, we got this percussion guy, he's on full board, and here we go. We're going to have to support him, and we need a bunch of equipment. That was kind of understood because the studio was very, very new and young, and they had 1 5-octave marimba. They had some other instruments, but the other instruments were more towards marching. They had a couple keyboards out there. I remember I went out to the very first rehearsal in August, and they had an old Deegan 264, not an artist special, but they had another one. It was a 284, I think it is. It's called a Xylo Marimba.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely beautiful instrument, but they had it out on the field in its original frame and everything. And I remember crossing my eyes and not trying to swear too much, but I literally was able to get it inside, and we replaced some of those instruments outside with some actual marching instruments that had frames and so forth that were appropriate. And then, the support financially was really incredible at that time. And it went on for a long period of time. It wasn't really till we got to about, I'd say, probably around 2015, 16, when recession hit in 2018, things took a dive. But I've always had terrific equipment budgets. Mm. And I remember even our library here, the Morgan Library, when you first came on as a new introductory faculty member, they gave you $5,000 worth of music.
Mm.
or requests that you can make that would be housed in the library. So I remember I gave them a list of $8,000 worth of stuff, and they bought it. And I was like,
nice.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. And they recently that happened too. Like a lot of the requests that I made early, I just kind of went crazy. And usually, typically, it's always been acclimated. Most of the equipment stuff that I bought, I remember buying like $150,000 worth of stuff right off the bat when I first got here.
Yeah.
That was really just to kind of outfit the studio with, you know, 4-5-octave instruments. We also were in the original, when I first got here in 2003, we had the original, it was the original library for CSU. Mm. Had been taken over by the music department as the university grew. And so it was not housed or intended at all for music. So I remember carrying instruments up and downstairs, and every time we took 5-octave out, and you know, we had to disassemble it and pick the low end part. And so it wasn't until 5 years later that we got a new building and facility, and which has been great. We have kind of 6 designated percussion rooms, which is fantastic. And yeah, it's just a really ideal situation with doors that are 54 inches. And,
yeah.
And, you know, the stuff that's
just got to get the, if you get the doorways right, we can, I can work with everything else.
You can hit it. No doubt, man. Yeah. Huge thing. So once we moved in here, I felt like we really had a home, and it works really well. It's really ideal. All the major performance halls, other than our Oregon Recital Hall, where we do our recitals, is up on the second floor, but we have a freight elevator for that. But everything else is really close and right down the hall, basically. So, yeah, equipment-wise, it's been really supportive. I've always had really good support. And to be honest with you, it hasn't been until the last 3 or 4 years that things have gotten tight, mm-hmm. and that budget has been reduced. I remember when I first got here, my operating budget every year was $40,000 for equipment. Nice. Yeah, that's not purchase and new stuff. That's just to maintain what I got. So every year I'd have every keyboard instrument retuned, every head replaced. Our cymbal acquisition was fantastic. Like, it was just really a lot of great maintenance. And so now I've had to become a little more frugal and a little more inventive and creative as far as maintaining stuff. So we get our instruments tuned every 3 years now, you know, and so forth. So but yeah, I've always, equipment-wise, it's been really fantastic. And facility-wise, once we got the new place, it's really ideal. I mean, where I went to school, in particular, I did my undergrad at Kent State and my doctorate at Northwestern. Both those places, from a facility standpoint, were not friendly to percussion. I remember Northwestern had it when I was there, 2001 through 2003, was probably one of the best studios I've ever seen.
Yeah.
It really... Will James all the way to Jake Nisley to Third Coast was all there at the same time. And that's just the name, some of the lower folks that were there. I mean, it was unbelievable. Yeah. The amount of student body, but our equipment and facility were horrible. Absolutely not great at all. And it was just 4 practice rooms for 25 majors, and everybody's performance major, everybody wants time. So you got really efficient with your practice time. And I remember every studio class we used to have down in Regenstein Hall, we used to carry a 5-octave Malatech marimba down the stairs. Not good. So the situation that I live in here at CSU is fantastic as far as that goes. So equipment has been great. Support from the university has been really terrific, and I've been able to do things, I think, here, with the population and notoriety of Colorado. You know, it's a relatively small state as far as population goes. Mm. It's got, you know, about 3 million people in Colorado. That's relatively low, you know, compared to Texas or California. So, anyways, what I'm able to kind of do here, I feel, is quite extraordinary considering all the you know, situation that we kind of live in. So
tell me a little bit more about how the music department fits in with the university and also the size and, you know, how, like, full-time, all that kind of stuff.
The big difference, I think, between this school and other schools that I've experienced, like University of Illinois, even when I was in Alabama, and knowing a lot of SEC schools, having students that teach in SEC schools and so forth, is that the music program here, I think, is a little more independent in some ways. And the big way is athletically. The athletic bands, the marching band, basketball, all that stuff there is not supported by the athletic program. We don't receive a dime from them. It's all in-house. And so marching band serves, as much as it is for, you know, game time entertainment in the fall, it also serves as a growing educational situation for music ed students in particular, in an outlet that way. So, yeah, I think there's a little more independence in our music department because we don't have that affiliation financially. That I remember, you know, down at University of Illinois, very much the whole band system at University of Illinois, which there's six concert bands there, the whole Halsey band building was all supported by athletics. All GTAs were supported by athletics. Marching band, the band, the actual, I think, faculty salaries for the band folks all came from athletics. It was very much different. And then you had the music building, which is on the other side of campus. It was almost like two separate worlds that way. So not necessarily that was bad, but there's definitely a service component to athletics that rode a little higher in the responsibility list as far as that goes. So that we definitely have much more independence that way as far as what we do. And if we choose to do six like halftime shows in the fall, that is our purview, not the athletic purview. It's not that they don't have their two cents, but they really have, you know, no kind of leverage as far as what that. So, I mean, that's one of the things. I think the other thing is that since I got here in 2003, student body has grown probably about 150 to about 200 students, but in particular, the faculty have grown immensely. I remember my faculty meeting since I first arrived in 2003. It was like there was like 16 of us, you know, like, hey, you knew everybody. And now I go to faculty meetings and it's close to, I think we have about 55 full-time faculty.
Wow.
So the amount of faculty that we have for the music department, and a lot of those positions are adjunct, but it's definitely become much more specialized.
Yeah.
What I would say. And we still have this kind of core of probably about 25 to 30 full-time faculty, but the applied and the specialization has grown. And I would imagine we're not necessarily unique that way.
Yeah.
But that's definitely how it's kind of gone, that we have a bigger teaching body that we have. And I think that's grown more exponentially than our students and our student body of that. I think from a student standpoint, what we offer is there's a lot of opportunity and diversity of what we do. And that's kind of my philosophy in general, versus maybe larger programs like UNT, Indiana. The sheer size of that, I think the curriculum and the uniformity of curriculum that students have to follow is very strict. There's a barrier system of other stuff. And we definitely have much more of an independent approach to student development, learning, and expectations. So it's more, and I personally think that's the way the market is going anyways, and that's what brings value to you as a musician and percussionist. And then the current trend is that you bring something unique and different to kind of the overall field. And instead of everybody, you know, I think if you go back even 20, 25 years, there's a certain job level and those opportunities, you know, you did X, Y, Z to get to there. And I think nowadays, man, who knows how you get to a job, but it seems like everybody takes a very unique and different path to get there. I know it used to be if you want to become an orchestral player or if you want to get like a master's degree at Eastman or a doctorate at Eastman, you needed to follow a very strict regime.
Right.
And to be honest with you, you know, now the people that are getting doctorates from the upper end schools like, you know, Yale or Eastman or even FSU, Indiana, some of the larger, more established schools, I think, you know, the backgrounds are really varied now. You get a large, I'm always amazed at and kind of happy to see people graduating with their DMEAs who have strong drum corps or marching backgrounds. That's something that's definitely evolved and seemed like it's been embraced more by those institutions. Yeah. It used to be a knock on you.
Right.
It used to be kind of a hit, like, oh, you did drum corps. Well, you know, your sound is probably this way and your thought process and your selection of repertoire probably falls into this. And I'm not sure that would jive with us, you know. Now I think people are proud of that.
Yeah.
And that has, you know, helped them. So, and there are so many great examples of that now, of people who have that background, heavy drum corps experience, that are in the orchestral field or in the, you know, that kind of upper institution of conservatory oriented orchestral playing.
Yeah.
Those are two different worlds now. They're kind of symbiotic of each other.
Yeah. Well, and not only that, also the amount of festivals that are going on now is like another outlet that that people have in a lot of these spaces.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, not only the orchestral festival, but all types. Yeah, like Chosen Vale or Aspen or any of the, you know, the summer programs that go on that can be very chamber music, like the SOCI, yeah.
Right.
All that stuff that goes
Sandbox,
on.
Sandbox, yeah.
Yep. All those are really a combination of a lot of different backgrounds of people that have like interests, you know, in the city, but the background that got them there isn't so structured anymore. And it used to be very, very uniform.
You know? Yeah.
It's nice to see.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a more open-minded, you know, perception of people's music abilities and what they bring.
Yeah. Well, I feel like that's changed, you know, over the years. I've been teaching about the same amount of time you have, you know, in terms of.
Yeah.
And I know that what's available to students now is we can't sit there and think you want to get a college job or you want to get an orchestral job. Now it's, there's all sorts of teaching. There's all sorts of performing, particularly in the chamber spaces like you're doing, where there's viable careers doing that. I mean, it's usually it's a portfolio style, but it is the way that it now works.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the crossover in those genres too has come more towards the middle too.
Yes.
I mean, in other words, you know, the whole drum corps outdoor approach used to be very, very, very different than it is now. Now it really, I mean, the teaching that I see and witness and the playing that I witness from that is much more in cognition with how we used to teach orchestral playing.
Yeah.
And still do. And I think there's plenty of things in orchestral music now. I know in percussion ensemble that is referencing approaches that we would take in a more marching
situation. Yeah.
You know, I know if you want to win for Call for Tapes, you've got to be clean, clean, and clean.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that really, I mean, that type of clarity, to be honest with you, sometimes I can render the best as far as meeting my Call for Tapes expectations through my marching students.
Mm-hmm.
They have that ear for, you know, that absolute sense of small refinement and vertical alignment. You know what I mean? Like, that they just have that. I don't have to kind of push towards that as much. And so, yeah, there's a lot of things that, you know, orchestrally or chamber music that have kind of lead that. I always think of like Sandbox Percussion and Andy Akio.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're playing a lot of the Pillars right now, and and talking to Andy about some of that and some of the interviews that Sandbox puts up, it's all about clarity and making sure things come really, really clear and just be able to read things on the first mark of clarity. So it's like those skills that you develop in drum corps in marching situations seem to really, really kind of becoming salient, you know, in our percussion ensemble, which is really cool. So, yeah, there's a lot of crossover. So I don't feel like we're talking differently so much
in
genres and toward those people. Mm-hmm. The only thing I see sometimes is just the repertoire sometimes, you know, of gearing towards. But I've had several students that have done drum corps and they're, you know, all about playing things like After Syrinx 2 and, you know what I mean? getting into, you know, larger, more abstract repertoire, which is really cool. So I just feel like everything is kind of more homogenizing, you know, in that way, which I think is important because I know that if I was an undergraduate student now, similar to how probably, you know, you and I were pushed in undergraduate, is that you want to try and be able to do it all to some degree. You want to, you know, create as many opportunities as you can. So yeah, you want to get your Afro-Cuban, you know, Tumadero playing together. You know, you want some hand drum stuff. You want to know the orchestral rep. You want to know some of the marimba rep. You know what I mean? Are you going to do that? Do you know the timpani rep? You know what I mean? Do you have some drum set chops together? Could you sit in a big band? You know, all that stuff that I was kind of encouraged to do to a degree. You know, I think that is definitely living now. Now there's another element to that, and a lot of it is, can you arrange? You know, what are your compositions like?
Yeah.
What is your technology skills like? Mm-hmm. Is a huge one. That's just part of a, you know, part of the many arrows that we need in your current quiver to kind of get things done. So it definitely is kind of broadened as far as, I think, you know, that and world music becoming, you know, more integrated and specified and clear as far as that goes. Can you play steel drums? Do you know anything about, you know, gamelan? Do you, all this stuff? So there's all these different factions, and I think knowing a little bit more is probably part of the current expectation. I think that's grown. But the nice thing is the information about how to get better at those is so much more readily available.
Oh, yeah.
That's the incredible part to me, you know, is that it's right there. It's really not that far. You don't have to travel to North India to really kind of learn, you know, tabla nowadays. You could get at least a baseline structure of that, you know, sitting at your desk. So there's a lot more available information, which makes it, but the expectation is that you continue to have a really wide and more and more varied skill set, you know, on that, which is really cool, you know, and of course, that's the greatest thing about percussion. That's the worst thing about percussion, you know, all that we are responsible to kind of have under our wing, but at the same venture of, you know, trying to be decent at something, you know, of that. So I kind of like where it's headed in the fact that there is a lot of cross-pollination between styles and genres and idioms and ensembles. And that, so what I encourage here at CSU is that we kind of push a little more towards what you really enjoy, what you're good at, which are typically very similar. Mm-hmm. Typically, we like to do stuff that we're good at, and therefore that's a lot of reason why we enjoy it. So I try and give the opportunity in my students anyways to kind of push that a little bit. So when they get out of here, they're inviting and bringing something that's unique to them, that resides a little more maybe in their passion and or is unique to the marketplace. So it's not a cookie cutter kind of approach. And that's something I've been doing. The way that curriculum flushes out with that is that in undergraduate degree anyways, it's 2 years and 2 years. First 2 years is kind of driven by what Shiloh and I come up with, and we have a checklist.
Yeah.
It's kind of the four main areas, which are drum sets, kind of keyboards, marimba in particular, and then timpani and snare drum, those four instruments. And we have kind of certain expectations, barriers of certain etudes, exercises, yeah. Rudiment scales, arpeggio, blah, 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 that have to be kind of crossed off to a certain level and certain degree with a certain sound. And then once you get past that, then you take an upper division qualifying exam, which kind of tests you on those. And once you pass that, which is typically at the end of your sophomore year, then the last 2 years become student driven. So yeah. What do you want to do in your lesson this week? You know what I mean? And then it's my job, I just feel like, to make sure whatever they choose to do, that it has some rigor behind it, that I'm pushing them in their expectation of that. But it's driven by them as far as the content area. And I feel like that gives them enough opportunity, typically in 3 to 4 semesters, mm-hmm. Kind of getting a strength or an interest or a weakness, you know, happening on that. And that's their opportunity to kind of move in their own direction on that. So, and then master's degree, I'm generally completely hands off as far as really what they want to do.
Yeah.
It's really driven completely by them. But then I just, again, I feel like it's my job to continue to demand, you know, quality.
Sure.
And they're continuing to learn. And that's really kind of the rigors where I, you know, I try and make my middle name as far as a percussion teacher anyways, most of the time. What's interesting about CSU is that, like most schools, I think, you know, the college landscape has changed so much. as you've seen since I started teaching back in the 90s. And it's when I first got to CSU, as an example of that, tuition here was about $6,000 a year. And now it's around, I think, about $15,000 to $16,000 a year for in-state.
Yeah.
My out-of-state is quite a bit more, but I think it used to be a very, very independently doable financial degree. Yeah, whatever degree you're going to get, but it really was doable. You could get a summer job and kind of pay for your degree.
Yeah.
Or take out very, very minimal amount of loans. You know what I mean? Yeah. And now it's a different world. And typically when I – it's not a matter of a lot of times, at least here – when undergraduates basically audition, it's a matter of, will I get any scholarship money? And right. or it's almost like the scholarship has to happen in order for them to go to school. Mm-hmm. So it's changed. And so I feel like the students I get now, generally, I don't maybe, you know, 10 years ago, I used to audition a lot more students. Mm. I get a little less, but the ones that audition seem to have a little more seriousness behind them, a little more drive, a little more preemptive understanding of what they're getting into.
Yep.
This 4-year degree thing is going to cost some money. And, you know, what are the outcomes? In other words, what can you do with this degree is definitely a bigger question that I answer now, if not the question, than what I used to be. I just like music. I just really want to do music. Sure. Yeah. Now it's like, okay, how am I going to pay my student loans? And what jobs have your students gotten? And, you know, there's a really direct line there that is forced, really, I think, by the tuition cost on it. I don't think it's necessarily bad. I just think it's more of a challenge. But I know the studio used to have, pre-COVID, probably back in 2015, 16, mm-hmm. and it was turning away a lot of students. And now, basically, I have a lot of good quality students audition, but I don't have the scholarship monies to throw at them. Mm-hmm. So generally, I matriculate a few less. And so we've actually taken on some minors, percussion minors, and there were boatloads of minors. But it's something that's new. I've never took a percussion minor or allowed minors here until probably about 3 or 4 years ago, post-COVID. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and that's just to fill out some of the numbers that we need and like the symphonic band, the lower band, and some of the other situations. So it means my teaching over the course of a week goes all the way from a minor, a percussion minor, who has maybe played in like 1 year of band in middle school, you know, likes percussion, wants to do a little bit of it, all the way to, you know, I got a master's student that just got into Aspen. You know what I mean? Like somebody that really high end. And sometimes those lessons are back to back where I'm teaching basic fundamentals of music all the way to really high, you know, advanced concepts of phrasing and gesture, you know? So it's really that's what's changed a lot for me, is that the variety and escape of abilities is really, you know, broadened. And that, so along with student interest is really expanded too, as far as what they're into, the variance of what they're into, the literature that they're into. And it used to be much more uniform than that. So kind of interesting. See where it's going.
Yeah. No, totally fascinating. It's kind of interesting to hear about that there's fewer students that you see in auditions, but you still get the ones who are serious. It just maybe, that way. And it's interesting because one of the things I was thinking about is that's happened here. And I'm wondering if it's a similar thing at your school, is we have a lot of double majors or they'll have a minor, but it's they'll do a BA instead of the music ed, but they'll be their other sciences or engineering or something like that. And music. Right. And we're like, I mean, I personally am like, this is awesome. This is like, I don't know if – are you getting some of that too?
Oh, yeah. Double majors have definitely exaggerated. Yeah. In other words, I think I've got currently four double majors, engineering, 2 computer science, and then biological sciences. I've got a few of those here, which is unique to CSU. But I think, that is definitely a plan B. Like, you know, if they could just do music, that'd be great. But there needs to be this other kind of more theoretically tangible, you know, income – generator down the future that would appease maybe the parents or themselves, you know, as far as their financial, you know, security down the road. And I understand that. Yeah. I think there's a much more realistic view of, you know, the professional musician, the percentage of how many players go on to make, you know, their life income full-time playing. That is extremely, you know, probably smaller than the NFL, you know what I mean, an NBA. But, yeah, that, I mean, that's a tough gig. And most of the people that I think we're much more honest about it right off the bat, too, when a student is here for music performance. I'm interested in music performance, and I'm like, well, it's great. You know, this is kind of how most people get that done. You know, they're teaching primarily, you know, they're, you know, playing to some degree, they're arranging, they're, you know, they're also working at Starbucks, like, you know, in other words, there's a lot of, it's kind of a variety of that, you know, freelance percussionists, really. And freelance today means you, you know, it's a big, wide open, variable day. You know, it's how you make your income through that, which a lot of us have done, you know, and eventually you kind of narrow it maybe to more of a playing situation if you're afforded that opportunity.
Right.
But it kind of scales. But when you first get out of college, it needs to be anything. Yes, 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 yes. Mm-hmm. I will do it all. Yeah, I will teach your four-year-old triangle. You know what I mean? So it needs to be whatever you got. Yes. You know, and then eventually you kind of simmer it down through successes, you know, to maybe do more of what you want. And if that happens to be playing, that's great. You know, but it's a very, very competitive and challenging, and it's only gotten more and more competitive. Mm-hmm. And most areas that are decently populated are pretty much saturated with good percussionists, you know. Yeah. So, yeah, it just means we've done, as, you know, teachers, we've done our job really well, you know, as far as generating. And that's the thing I remember, too, that, you know, when I was growing up and going to school in my undergrad in particular, in the 80s and 90s, it was the amount of competent percussionists, you know, was definitely a smaller percentage, not even close to what it is now.
Right.
Now, there's so many great musicians and percussionists walking around. It's just common. So you really kind of, you know, that's where I think being unique in a certain way, you know, really kind of makes you stand out. But again, I think it comes down to a lot of times success is longevity, having something unique, and then persistence. Longevity in the fact that you really enjoy this. You can't see yourself doing anything else but this. And, you know, this is really your passion. And I just really like this. And you just keep hammering away at it. And after time, I think, you kind of create, you know, reputation. You create a situation where you have a product or either teaching or playing that people really enjoy and want to kind of support, and you find a way to kind of make it work for you, you know. In addition to having a plan B, I know several people out there say that you're successful if you can make, you know, basically 50% of your income from either playing or teaching music. And that's a success, you know, that at least nowadays, that would be, you know, a strong success in that. So, and I would follow that very closely. I know when I first got out of school with my master's at Illinois, I was really hell-bent on being an orchestral percussionist. So I took I think it was 17 orchestral positions or auditions, I should say, and over the course of 3 years, and it took me a while. And eventually I was making it to the finals on some. I mean, San Antonio, there's a few others that I made finals, and eventually I won a position with the Columbus Symphony as a section player, and I played there for 2 years before the actual symphony folded and then restarted 2 years ago. But it was...
Is this Columbus, Ohio?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That was kind of my push there. But in the meantime, while I was taking auditions and I was teaching at high schools, I was basically playing in a band. I was also playing steel drums on the side. I had a jazz vibe gig, you know, on Thursday night at the Blue Martini. Like, I used to, do everything and anything. I was subbing here and there with a few other orchestras. I was arranging marching band music. So anything and everything I can get my hands on, you know, to make it work. And yeah, eventually I was able to win that position, and then it worked out for 2 years. I played there, and then the symphony folded, and I got the opportunity. Somebody called me and said, "Hey, we're looking for a percussion instructor at UAB." Mm. I got that, and I figured I'd take that. And so, and then I really enjoyed college teaching. I thought that was, yeah, really cool. And so I just, yeah, kind of followed that. And then after 6 years of that, I actually went back and did my doctorate then.
Mm.
And implying I wasn't having much with just a master's at that point from UAB in teaching experience at UAB, I really needed a doctorate to get into a 10-year program.
Yeah.
So I went back to Northwestern at that point, which is really hard to give up a salary to go back to school again.
Yeah.
But it paid off. Yeah. So it's kind of an interesting trajectory of where students are now, but it I think the same things apply nowadays that used to apply, and that is that persistence, a sense of passion in it. A lot of times you just got to keep that driving and outlast other people.
Yeah.
You know, I know, I obviously, like, if you're interested in college teaching, the terminal degree is almost a given nowadays.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you've got to have a doctorate, really. And there's so many people out there walking around with doctorates. I subbed with the Fort Collins Symphony last week, actually.
Mm-hmm.
The section, the principal is a past student of mine, Leo Canali, is a fabulous guy. But the other rest of the section, they were all like doctoral students getting their doctorate, and fantastic players all the way around, all of them.
Yeah.
And yeah, just sweating it out with the Fort Collins Symphony, you know, on a Wednesday night.
Yeah.
Just kind of cool to see the level, you know, of that and the drive there. But yeah, that seems like a really common denominator.
Yeah.
Nowadays, to have a terminal degree along with lots of experience, you know, and I know that when I first got to college at Kent State studying with Michael Burritt, when he got that job, he was, I think he was 23 years old, right out of the gate. So he did 2 years at Ithaca with Gordon Stout, and then he did finished up his undergraduate at Eastman his junior senior year, and then got a 1 year master's performance degree, a certification at Eastman. So he was in school 5 years and then immediately got the Kent State job.
Yeah.
You know, at 23 years old. And that really does not happen that way nowadays.
Yeah.
And it used to not be too uncommon that you could do that much school and then get a, you know, a college teaching job.
Yeah.
And now really you've got to do the terminal degree. You've got to get kind of that extra one. And then you probably need to go in a situation. I mean, Mike's first job at Kent State, pretty much he had to teach, I think, a music appreciation class his first year.
Sure.
But the rest of it was all studio stuff, percussion ensemble, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He taught methods the first couple of years and then lessons. But nowadays it's like you need to teach out in the mountains somewhere or rural, and you need to teach like theory, music history, world music, technology,
yeah,
and make a little bit of percussion over here, you know.
Right.
And then eventually, you know, you kind of work through teaching experience up to, you know, to being maybe a full-time applied teacher if that's what you'd like. So the road is longer. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. And you got to kind of be more versatile or more open for a little bit longer, you know, before you kind of get focused on that. So, and again, that's just meaning that better people get into those positions too. And I shouldn't say better people. I just say people that are, have more experience and more kind of varied experiences on that with more schooling generally, probably a stronger knowledge base on a lot of different things, but yeah.
When the people I've talked to on the show who don't have doctorates or didn't and like have kind of the full-time position, it's been interesting because a lot of them almost like, there were a couple of people I could think of who their undergrad, they almost had a master's level thing. Like either right. It was a small studio and they ended up teaching a lot in that, or they were, you know, this all-star player from a young age. And so they gigged a ton very early on. And but it's rare. I mean, and you know it from, I'm sure you've been on job searches a lot in your position outside of your field, outside of like the percussion side, but where you're just like, we can just go doctoral pile,
right?
Everyone else pile. And if we get to this other pile,
Exactly.
It's only because we fully fleshed out.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. It's real easy to weed through those in that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got 100 applicants. Yeah. No doctorate. Okay. See if you know what I mean? Like it's really, it's sad, but yeah, it's just, again, it speaks to what I was talking about before of that, not necessarily saturation, but just there's so many really strong people out there that are qualified, at least, you know, with the amount of schooling that goes on and the education of it, you know. So even when I go to, I think the levels of like playing that goes on as well,
you know, has
really climbed as well. I know even the regional orchestras that I play with, you know, sometimes too, always amazed at the overall level of just the people walking around that this is not a full time. This is just a side gig, you know,
or
they have a regular day job and then they play bassoon or whatever, but the level that they play it is really phenomenal. And then their background, like, oh yeah, you know, yeah, I'm a computer analyst basically for IBM here. You know, that's what I do. But, oh yeah, and I have a doctorate from Indiana on bassoon. And
right,
I play it on the side, you know, five concerts a year with a four column symphony, like extremely qualified, you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
That you definitely wouldn't happen, you know, probably 30, 40 years ago in that capacity, maybe, you know, general rule. And I'm not speaking for everybody, but yeah. So is it, the level is raised and the bar is raised. Definitely good. And so the overall amount of quality, you know, music making, I think is really, really quite wonderful. You can go just about anywhere, any place and find something that is really, you know, excellent and representative, really high end, you know, expression, which is really cool. So it's cool. It also just makes it, you know, a strong challenge to actually make a living of it if that's what you're trying to do, you know?
Yeah.
So I think as we were talking about like double majors, you know, something that they obviously really enjoy is making music, but maybe there's a much better sense of realistic idea of maybe this is something that, you know, wouldn't support other ideas that I have about life as far as like maybe having a family or more of a regular, consistent, you know, work schedule. But this is something that can be, I still want to do to the highest level and that level expression that I got from doing it well. That's sense of, you know, confidence that I build from it, but doing it more on a supplemental, like this is part of my life, not my whole life. Thing. And I think that's an absolute great thing.
Well, and it's not only in the, you know, the like the professional sense versus the in the way kind of we can think about somebody playing music maybe after they get one of these degrees. I always think of a comment that a visual artist once made to me, which was, we need the people who pay for the art too. So it's like they could, they don't have to be the players, but maybe they become the donors or maybe their children are like, you like really put resources into them. They're like, there's all these different ways that that manifests itself that may not be a performer, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think that's a great way of putting it too, that, you're creating support, you know, for the arts as well. So I know the audiences, you know, continue to change too, but I'm always amazed at the compactness of our current audiences. The fact that it's not, and a lot of what we do too, especially what we do like in chamber music and so forth, you know, that whenever we kind of, it seems like more and more of the audience that is listening is informed and knows more and has a specific taste for a certain thing. And it feels more like a boutique, you know, performance. In other words, we're really good at this and we have this certain little niche that we do. And then here's our little niche audience. Like it's more specialized that way, you know, especially in chamber music and especially, but I even go to like, I play with a Colorado Bach Ensemble, and we did Bach's Christmas Oratorio, which is like most oratorios from Bach. You know, it's no small thing. It's it's 3.5 hours of playing, and box music, which is absolutely beautiful, but it's very, very similar, you know, piece to piece, you know, over 63 different movements. Yeah. And I'd say there's about three, you break it down into three different kind of styles of pieces among 63.
Yeah.
And they really do not sound that much varied, you know, between them. And you're going to sit through 3 hours of that.
You know,
on that. So that takes a certain level of commitment from the audience, you know.
Right.
I mean, this is a really terrific ensemble, one of the best choirs I think we have in Colorado anyways. But beautiful performance all the way around from all the players. And we did six performances of it.
Mm-hmm.
I was amazed to see much audience at all.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, but there was a decent audience. But I find that after a couple of the performances, I got a lot of emails like, oh, you guys sounded great. And it was all like the people that I – like Doug Walter from CU was in the audience. Like it was extremely informed.
Right.
Like a couple section members from the Colorado Symphony, like Bill Hill, some other people that were in the audience. And man, I'm playing for the musicians who could play this stuff, you know?
Right, yeah.
Those are the people who want to kind of see that stuff, you know, which is really kind of interesting. It's a very, very musician-to-musician almost situation. Like, I play, and then at some points I'm in the audience, you know? But it's like you're playing for almost like other musicians, other informed musicians that way. It's not kind of a general, you know, public. There's some of that, too, but I think there's a portion of it that is informed. It's kind of like our percussion ensemble music that we play, you know, like a PASIC.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the if you win the call for tapes, you're playing for such an informed audience there that you know, people know those composers, they know those performances, they know, you know, the level and everything like that. So and that's what you're aiming for, you know, is to play for that informed audience. It's not kind of the general public. And so I think there's something that always kind of pops out of my head, and that's something when I first got here, and I had quite a bit of money for guest artists, and so I got Steve Schick in one time. Yeah, it was fantastic. And of course, Steve being extremely approachable and down to earth, even in my relatively young studio there, and he came in and did his usual, you know, Rebons and Zaffa and XY and Silver Streetcar and Bone Alphabet and Touche and played all the hits
as you
all
know.
The hits, all the, you know,
heavy
right. And singing the melodies. Woo.
Yeah. Everyone starts dancing the Bone Alphabet, you know, it's a good time.
Oh man, they were just going nuts. Yeah. It was incredible. Like recital. Incredible.
Yeah.
Like, he just played it. And, but his big thing is, you know, as you read his book or talk to him, his thing is that he's kind of known for taking this really heavy music, academic music a lot of times, and playing it for the average Joe. You know, he's notorious for playing it for construction sites and, you know, elementary schools. He's playing Rebons, you know.
Yeah.
Like, you know, but I think it's doing it in a way and – of course, he's such a terrific speaker and talker and encapsulating, you know, articulates ideas so well that by inviting the audience into his little world and then really, you know, not only having a great performance of it, but selling it through his body motions, his passions and, you know, his persona, you know, is really he could really turn on a lot of people that had no knowledge of this whatsoever through this really challenging music. And I think that's something that I'm always trying to aspire to, you know, and not only my performance, but my students' performance of, you know, could we play this for a bunch of elementary kids and they would be digging it,
you
know, into it. They could sense our energy. They could sense, you know, how much invested we have in it and what we're trying to communicate. Is that salient enough right there that they could, you know, pick up on that and enjoy it? You know, and that's something I think that I know a lot of times in our music that we get into, the very complex stuff, you know, if we're playing like Vignale Water or something, you know, like that, that takes so much on our end to get so it's readable and digestible and, you know, in a sense, grooves, you know, and it's making sense and we understand it, that it can be perceived by somebody that doesn't know anything about it, you know, and still enjoyed. And that, I think, is a great It's something I've always, you know, tried to push on that. And I think that's kind of, in a sense, where we're headed. But I just find a lot of times, too, the audience we're playing for knows.
Yes.
Knows exactly what's going on or what's not going on. You know what I mean?
Yeah. They're like, you should check your tuning and measure 52 if you.
Right, exactly.
I think check that out.
4 cents sharp on that bit right there. Yeah.
May have sounded different to you because you're right next to the drum, but in the
right, but out in the audience where it matters.
Yes. Awesome. Well, Eric, let's back up now. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in upstate New York, Syracuse.
Okay.
My mother was a choir director.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, she was a high school choir director, but also conducted the Syracuse Chorale, which was kind of the main orchestra for that kind of city and area, and often sang stuff with the Syracuse Symphony, which has since folded, but was going at the time. And I went to a really small high school called Jordan Elbridge High School, but it had a really fantastic band program. Unusually good. It had some really wonderful, a guy named Bill Plange was my first band director. A guy named Willie Crocker was kind of my first kind of percussion teacher, who was a slash band director. But
yeah,
both those guys were Eastman grads, and they right down the road, but fantastic musicians. And our marching band did really well. We won state championships for years and years in our class, which is a lower class. And then but my mom in particular was a big influence on me in that she parents divorced when I was young. So I was always hanging out with mom, and she was really busy always doing music stuff. So I literally probably remember all the way from when I was about 7 or 8, if not younger, all the way till I was like 16 and finally got my driver's license, of constantly going to choir concerts and over her constant.
Yeah.
Like, so yeah, I was always kind of being flushed out with music in one way or another. And so I was really lucky that way, and being exposed to a lot of just music rehearsals and playing and everything when I was growing up. And so I started on piano for a little while, and then I started taking percussion lessons when I was pretty young too. I actually started on saxophone, but the breathing and spit drove me nuts. There was something about I had such a headache after any type of rehearsal or anything like that. I was like, Mom, I can't, I need to breathe. And so percussion seemed, obviously a benefit that way. So I started taking percussion lessons with a guy named Nick Barada. And Nick Barada was basically a teacher at the local high school, West Genesee High School. And West Genesee had a really strong marching band in upstate New York, won state championships for the, I think it was 5A at that time. But Nick was known for being a marching band director, was a New England Conservatory grad as a percussionist. Really gifted musician and a great influence on me as far as teaching. He just had great students, and I was lucky to get on with him. I wasn't a great practicer. I remember he had a really interesting way of motivating you, but he would get you in a headlock and basically drag you around the building and tell everybody who didn't practice that day. Actually, he was that type of, I learned a lot from him. He was really terrific way of, and I still, a lot of times if I get out my prep book, I still has his writing in it and stuff. And it's still great concepts that I still teach to this day that I learned from him. And then I got lessons with another guy named Herb Flower, and Herb Flower was the principal percussionist of Syracuse Symphony at that time. And it was a former teacher of Mike Burrett and some other folks, but was kind of the lead teachers in the Syracuse area. And I was really thankful to have some lessons with him. I probably took about a year's worth of lessons from him. And those are really, really significant too, as far as learning, in particular, sound concepts that he shared into me. And he really got me reading a whole lot on keyboard instruments. That's the one thing he really advanced in playing. So between those two teachers, I was really lucky. I also had some great marching band instructors, Jim Ahern, is one guy named Rick Rogers from upstate too. Those two, both arranging, playing were really good. And I took a variety of lessons from some other folks in the area, but it's a really great area as far as, having a strong kind of percussion tradition in music development program. And band programs up there to this day are really, really strong. There's a lot of great stuff going on in upstate New York anyways. I have a long tradition of rudimental drumming in that area too, and that's something that I definitely got into. And then I auditioned for Cadets, Garfield Cadets back in that. It was 88. And I got a tenor position. Mm. And I was headed towards Alldays in May, and I got mono.
Oh, no.
I was out for about 3 or 4 weeks, and I wasn't able to finish the season. Yeah, and that was my first kind of run-in with Tom Ungst and Tom Hannum.
Yeah.
In there. And then the year after that, actually, I had a couple other things going, but I ended up marching with Dutch Boy, which is Kitchener, Ontario.
Oh, okay.
Snare with them 1 year, and that was because there was a guy I ran into, JJ Pipitone, who's from Rochester originally, and he really was like, yeah, you don't want to go Cadets, man, just go down the road with me to Dutch Boy. And there was a guy named there was a couple people, but there was a guy named Rod Meckley who marched Cadets that was teaching Dutch Boy at the time, and they kind of coerced me in doing Dutch Boy. So I did Dutch Boy for a season. And that was great. I really enjoyed that too. I learned a lot from that. And it was a guy named Brent Montgomery was his name. And Brent taught Blue Stars and taught Star of Indiana in 1993 along with him. But yeah, anyways, it was a terrific, and he was my primary kind of caption head and or drum instructor that summer in Dutch Boy. It was great. I learned a lot from all those guys. And I still have a lot of things that I teach in that are direct quotes from him. Anyways, that's kind of more or less my background. And then I ended up studying with Mike Burrett at Kent State when he was there getting that. And that was monumental. And then I went to the Stevens camp, Lee Howard Stevens camp, and I learned a lot from there. I also studied with Paul Janchich for a while at Cleveland Orchestra. He had a summer program for a couple summers, and I did that. Yeah, and then I ended up going to do a master's degree at University of Illinois with Tom Siwi when he was there. And then I just really got on the audition circuit and ended up eventually winning a job with the Columbus Symphony for 2 years, played with them, and then I got to UAB. But yeah, that's kind of where things kind of rolled for me.
That's the short version of your path. So talk about a few of those items. One, what were some of the early, you mentioned sound concepts when you were in high school.
Yeah.
Is there stuff like from that you still think about or use on that level?
Yeah, the way it was explained to me back then, in particular, Nick would talk about it a little bit, but I think the one that organized it the most for me, and it was just a school of approach, and that was Herb Flower used to talk about the Eastman approach, and it was really from William Street that kind of projected through John Beck in that approach, and it still to this day is the way I tend to teach orchestral playing, and that is the concept of open ringing sounds that you're always as a default. This is not for everything, but this is like push power on, go to play. This is how you should sound. If you don't have contacts, if you don't have a style, you know, just how you produce instrument. And that is really, and Mike Burrett was the great reinforcer of all that actually in his approach, but it was really trying to produce very open ringing, uninhibited sounds from the instrument that are long in nature. In other words, try and produce long motions in and out of the instrument and long sounds.
Yeah.
And the reason that you wanted to do that was you generally want to blend with other instruments well.
Yeah.
And generally almost all the other instruments, strings, winds, brass, tend to produce generally longer sounds than we do as percussion.
Yeah.
So blend with them into kind of create that same sense of sustain and blend with them that this is kind of our motivation and the way we should kind of produce sound in general. we have plenty of attack built into our instruments. So it's something we want to kind of, in a way, diminish that and kind of go with something that is more sustained. And so that is kind of the one of the premier, I would say, fundamental approaches that I have in producing kind of technique, you know, sounds that back through the technique of it.
Yeah.
So it was always a concept that Herb Flower used to tell me all the time is that, you know, that you should put as much, as little skin as possible to maintain control of the stick as you play.
Yeah.
Sometimes you'll need more, sometimes you need less, but the minimum is what you're aiming for all the time. And so that concept, and then working with the instrument as much as possible. So using as much rebound as you can, always coming away from the instrument. And the concept of pulling out sound is something that, you know, was they were he was really big on, but same thing. And for variable reasons. So this is something that when I got into the marching thing, everything is so much, especially in the battery approach, everything is downstroke so much.
Yeah.
That I actually had to kind of learn, which is unusual. I think
like you learn how to downstroke kind of.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I had some of that in me from my marching band high school stuff, but it was something that, in particular Herb had really, and Nick had really kind of got onto me of producing la, 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 la sound, stop tick, tick, ticking. You know what I mean?
Oh, sure.
That was kind of their approach to everything. And so whether or not you played snare drum, timpani, or marimba, you were always trying to allow things to stop and start at the top of the stroke, not the bottom. And so, obviously the drumming that we do in more of a drum corps approach is always a lot of times for uniformity of visual, and that's all to stop it close to the head or have a reference point there.
Yeah.
Which, so anyways, as far as the orchestral kind of sound concept that I got from Herb in particular, I think it was that always trying to produce more relaxed, open ringing sounds. And that's the kind of big push that I've always had on that. And it was always, it was funny as it kind of went along, and it was always kind of reinforced in a slightly different way. But when I studied with Tom Freer for a while, when I was playing with the Columbus Symphony, I used to go up to Cleveland and have my 2.5-3 hour lesson with Tom.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was like, I got about an hour. And then, you know, it started one by the time 3:30 rolled around. We were always like, maybe we should wrap it up here, you know. Fantastic lessons. Like, I learned so much from him. He was so giving.
Yeah.
But it was the same concept. Like, you know, everything needs to be, you need to kind of lift and pull and, you know, get out of the way of the head, get out of the way of the instrument, you know, let the instrument do its stuff. And it was always for that kind of open clarity, but the clarity is achieved through, kind of lightness, you know, and activating without impeding is the way we'd say it. So, it was reinforced by Tom generally. Mike, Burritt was very much into that same, kind of concept of relaxation and gesturing. And that's a big Mike thing that I got from him is that. And the people that you went to school with or influenced by, I always really enjoy. Like when I watch Chris Lamb play, if you get to see him play, it's very, very relaxed approach to snare drum.
Yeah.
Anything he plays, but there's a lot of gesturing. And same with Steve Gadd was a huge influence on Mike Burritt and me as well. But when I watch him play, there's always a sense of connection and movement, continuous movement in their playing. And so the kind of the sharp, stabby playing was something that was always selected for very unique stylistic demands. But as your general approach should be kind of avoided at all costs, really.
Yeah.
And that generally that's how it rolled through the Cleveland Orchestra with Tom and Paul that I got from there, those guys. And same with Mike was Mike was really into movement as a player. He's the one that kind of got me into thinking about how I look when I play.
Mm.
And a lot of times that was not as important, but it's almost like an equal partner to how you sound as you play, you know. But I learned a lot from him as far as like even molar technique of gesturing that and continuing motions on marimba in particular was something that Mike got me into. Because when I first started seriously playing marimba, in undergrad with Mike, it was something. It tended to be, I tend to have that drum core kind of stabby downward motion. And I was wondering why my hands were taking such a beating and everything like that. And
of course.
So Mike was very, you know, keep continuing motions. Like Malahat should stay in motion the whole time. And if you got time, you should hang out at the top, not at the bottom. So that was something that we worked on. And then when I went to the Stevens camp, you know, Lee reinforced the same thing, but it was just, he just did it in such a definitive, organized way. Like, okay, here's your six stroke types. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
Like, here's, you know, you got the resurrection stroke and you got the agonemic stroke and you got the piston stroke and you got all these different strokes, you know, and you could label each one like, no, that's the academic stroke. Yeah. See how that extra little blip right there. Yeah. That's part of this stroke. You know, he kind of organized it, you know, in a way. But it almost always came back to stopping at the top and or continuing motions. And that generally, as you play the instrument, especially a large instrument like marimba, where you have multiple targets all the time that you're moving around, that continuation of motion not only helps your accuracy, but improves the sound immensely as far as controlling, you know, overall phrase and controlling independent dynamics within mallets, and all that stuff tends to roll off the instrument so much better. And you just look much more elegant and in control as you play. And it doesn't, you know, feel like you're wrestling quite so much. You know what I mean? Such a large instrument that way. So, yeah, all those things were kind of reinforced, which is really cool that I learned that. Sometimes it just was confusing for me because a lot of times I'd live in both worlds of some of the market stuff, which had so much visual uniformity issues with that. And you were less – it wasn't – sound quality actually is something that Tom Hannum started talking about. But it wasn't necessarily sound quality in the fact that it's something that developed a little later when we're still on Mylar heads.
Yeah.
You know, get clarity out of that, you actually pushed in. You actually played below the head.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was part of that whole genre. And it wasn't – Tom started to get away from that. And as we got into Kevlar heads, there's so much rebound there that they started, you know, moving away from that.
Well, you'd injure your hands, like, right away if you tried to play that way.
Yeah. Yep. That and just the tension of the head went up, so it cut a little better. You didn't need to quite do that anymore, where you have a low tension head, a larger drum in general. And so, yeah, you had to kind of work hard to get clarity out of it. Work hard meaning that, yeah, a lot of times you are just, yeah, beating the head literally. And so that movement away and then, you know, talking about sound quality in marching stuff in particular in the higher drums like snares and tenors, that's something that kind of evolved right at the end of my marching experience, you know, into the 90s and 2000. Now, yeah, I think that's much more relaxed. Also, the cadets back in those days, in Dutch Boy, who was being taught, you know, in the snare line when I marched, it was being taught by a cadet, Rod Meckley. He, you know, a very similar approach to that. In other words, you know, still playing into the head, trying to get quality. And that started to evolve after I kind of left the idiom of that and that, which I was thankful to see. But it used to be a very wrist, 100% wrist-generated stroke too. And now when I see it, there's so much extra fluidity and forearm, shoulder movement. And that is beautiful to see, actually. That relaxation, the extra larger molar-esque, you know, approach to the playing, I think is a much less rigid. And it, part of the cadets was their style of being kind of the toy soldier, you know, and the fact that they did a toy soldier show back in the 80s, early 80s, you know, of they just looked like it and they wanted – the only thing that moved was basically the stick, you know. Prior to that was – extra and took away from the visual uniformity of what they're looking for. And they kind of held on to that for a long time. So I remember, some of the camps we'd played, it was like, it was a very rigid, you know, wrist on out approach to that. And definitely that has moved away from that now. And it's much more fluid, healthier approach, not only to your physique, your physical manifestation of playing that much, for that long, but also just the sound that you generate from that too is less forced, mm-hmm. less rigid. And again, with our drums now and the way they're tuned and supported, I think the articulation, you know, is all there too. It doesn't need to be driven, if that makes sense. So obviously the styles come a long way, but they live in a similar place to how we'd approach like an orchestral drum, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, and I was wondering if you had considered how your mom's choral background is even related to this and the way that they produce and capture sound.
Yeah, I mean, it's another thing that I talk about with my students, but Mike Burrett was another initiator of singing things a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it's the whole, whether you're singing or whether you're playing a wind instrument or anything, when you breathe and breathe out and how that makes sound, generally tends to, be part of making similar emotions, therefore similar sounds to that of, you know, having to preempt that. But the way that sound is generated with something that is long and then you shorten it, you know what I mean? Rather than something that's short that you're trying to get long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Vice versa, but it has a lot to do with kind of motions, and that the physical motions that we do with our hands and our forearms is kind of similar to our lung motion that we have in that. But yeah, I think generally just the beauty of, I think, singing is that almost everything tends to be long and we have to work hard to make it short.
Mm-hmm.
By default, it is a long thing, and that's in percussion, it's almost the opposite, but that's where we're headed for, is that natural ascension, at least in most orchestral playing, of having something long in that way. Yet it's naturally short in articulation. But what I enjoyed about singing, what I got a lot out of singing, because I sang in choir all through middle school and high school, in addition to doing band. I was lucky that this really small high school I went to in middle school, which were all the same. In other words, my school from 7 all the way to 12 was the same building.
Mm, sure.
And so you could participate in marching band for, 7 through 12. But you could also participate in multiple things. Like you could be in sports. You could also be in band. You could also be in the music hall. You could be in choir all the time. So I was lucky I took advantage of that. But singing helped me a lot, too. Made theory a whole lot easier for me in ear training when I was in undergrad. But a lot of it was the concept of phrasing.
Yeah.
In that, you had one breath for this one phrase, which makes it this one thing rather than four separate things or 19 separate things. So when I got to school too, something that Mike Burrett was really big into is like if you were learning relatively heavy marimba piece, develop your phrasing or how you would want to phrase it. You wouldn't actually play it. You would sing it.
Yeah.
Have almost everything same, because we could naturally sing it easier than we could probably play it a lot of time. Mm-hmm. And so just because the amount of time we invest in our voice and using it as an expression tool and communication tool. So he would always have any, and he used to rip on me at first because I used to sing rhythms like dig it, dig it up, dig it up, dup, dup. And he was always like, man, you're such a drummer. Like,
right. Yeah.
He was always like, try going yabba dabba dum dum. He would have me do kind of almost like a Flintstones, yabba dabba dum dum dum. But he was trying to make me feel things longer.
Yeah. You know,
with sounds like dee da 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 da, yabba dabba da, dee da, like that way. So he'd have me sing almost every phrase that I was going to do. Okay, this four measures right here. Can you sing that for me?
Mm-hmm.
You know, at first I was like, well, yeah, I can, but you know, I'm playing the marimba right now.
Yeah.
Took a little while, but I found that it was a great tool in the fact that I could naturally sing what I wanted to do and generate the idea of how I wanted to phrase this. Mm-hmm. And then I could work to get it happening through the marimba. That was an easier path to do rather than just, why don't you just crescendo to here and do that? You know what I mean? Plus, when you sing it, there tends to be a sense of emotion behind it that you don't necessarily get if you just talk like crescendo to here and then decrescendo this and then slightly crescendo this and decrescendo that.
Yeah.
You know, sing it, there's a natural feeling emotion behind that phrase where you can feel the tension kind of draw or you can release the tension emotionally, and I think that helps you kind of develop the phrase a little more logically or intentfully as you do it. And then you work to kind of get it through your instrument. He used to have me sing quite a bit on snare drum too, to make that much more lyrical. I remember the Peter's Intermediate Studies, we used to sing quite a bit, like yum digga dum dum dee, yaga digga dum 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 dum, you know, even though it's just mezzo forte for two players.
Right. Yeah.
It would give a lot of intent and agogic accent and feeling towards certain things. There's a couple etudes in the Intermediate Studies which I really adore, and that's in particular number, the last one, 32, is great. There's also another one early, which is number 11, where you have multimeter. Mm-hmm. You have a 3-4 followed by 6-8. It's the same exact rhythm, beam differently right. within the meter.
Yeah.
But then you're going to imply the meter in it, and so therefore you put different emphasis on that. And he would always have me sing those before I'd play it to get those. So singing is something I got, you know, obviously in high school, in other words, I was able to do that, I think, pretty depth. But Mike is somebody that always said that you have that, you should use that to develop this thing. You know what I mean?
Awesome.
You don't communicate as well, or, you know, that way through. So,
gotcha.
Yeah, Mike still does that quite a bit, but I find that's an effective tool for my students as well as myself, is that singing component.
And we'll get to part two with Eric Hollenbeck next week, so stay tuned. This week's rave is the very recently celebrated 50th anniversary of Saturday Night Live, particularly its live show that aired this past Sunday on NBC and available with clips all over YouTube and on Peacock. SNL has long been a show I've enjoyed and have kept up with over the years. While the skits aren't always that good, the ones that are funny really hit and are a lot of fun to rewatch. And there is a lot that has come out of that show that seems to really seep into the American culture in a wide array of ways. In particular, and up to today, the show has been really good at breaking new musical acts, either at their peak or just before. And I've always enjoyed seeing those appearances on air. Peacock and NBC have been putting out a ton of documentary content about the show throughout much of the calendar year. And I really appreciate it, because it allowed the 50th anniversary show to be more of a celebration of skits and characters with only a few montages. One of the documentaries that did come out that I quite enjoyed was directed by Questlove, called Ladies and Gentlemen, 50 Years of Music on SNL. This one was good and informative, though it went on a bit long. But my personal favorite part of that documentary was the focus on musical acts that were on the more unusual and avant-garde side that appeared in the first 10 years of the show. For example, Saturday Night Live featured some of the first national appearances of groups like the Talking Heads, the hip-hop group The Funky 4+1, the B-52s, and then also appearances from people like Captain Beefheart and Fear. You're not alone if you've never heard of those groups, but particularly if you're not at all familiar with Fear. This was a hardcore punk group that performed at John Belushi's request in the early 80s and turned into a complete and utterly chaotic situation on stage and off. Truly, it is one of the more bonkers clips to find somewhere online and watch in its entirety, because it's incredibly different from anything you would see normally on that show. For the actual 50th anniversary show, there were a bunch of recurring skits that came back for another appearance with the original cast members in those roles, like Scared Straight, Alien Abduction, Bob Goulet and Lawrence Welk, John Mulaney's musical episodes, Debbie Downer, and others. The personal favorites were the return of Black Jeopardy, featuring Eddie Murphy playing Tracy Morgan, and Tracy Morgan right next to him playing some random dude and playing it completely straight. I also loved Bronx Beat with the return of Amy Poehler and Maya Rudolph, who had Mike Myers' Linda Richman from Coffee Talk show up. There was an extended Q&A with Tina Fey and Amy Poehler. That was great. And then there were musical performances throughout, including Bookends by Paul Simon, who was on the second episode, and Paul McCartney, who showed up regularly throughout the years, to open and close the show. My two personal favorite moments included the most unusual in memoriam package ever, where longtime host Tom Hanks introduced clips in the in memoriam that have not aged well and show how comedy has changed and evolved over the years, which occurred particularly in regards to race and sexism throughout the time. That was kind of amazing. And then there was Adam Sandler's 50th anniversary song, which actually included in memoriam segments, funny banter, and shout outs to many of the crew who've made the show work over the past 50 years. There was a lot to take in over those 3.5 hours. And if you're not up for watching every single minute on Peacock, then definitely check out that and many, many performances and clips and documentaries that are out there right now on YouTube, on Peacock, and elsewhere. Check out the 50th anniversary Saturday Night Live showcases. And that's our show. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and leave a comment and a rating. You can find every episode and the show notes at the homepage at petezambito.com/Pete's Percussion Podcast, the episodes. Show is also on SoundCloud and Spotify and many other podcast locations. If you're on Facebook, like the page Pete's Percussion Podcast. You can find me there on Instagram and X at Pete Zambito or by email at petesperkpod@gmail.com. And I'll catch you next week for part 2 with Eric Hollenbeck.